You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, August 18th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Bienvenue. How's everyone?
Quite well, sir.
Good, thanks.
Becca, you got your computer problem sorted out?
Well, no. I'm just on a different computer now.
Okay.
My graphics card died, tragically.
What computer did that happen in?
My MacBook. It's a known problem with 2011 MacBook Pros, so...
And of course, Apple will just replace it, right? No problem.
No, this is one of the few times, actually. This is the first time that I've run into a problem that isn't easily being fixed by Apple, and so I'm very disappointed in them.
Ever since Steve Jobs died, shit has gone downhill. Sorry to say it.
I don't know.
Is that?
I mean, this problem has been going on for quite a while, apparently. Like, it's been a known problem in the computers that they haven't done anything about. That probably predates his death, but...
Yep. The real problem... is that it's not Scottish.
It's crap.
Nice segue.
It's crap.
It's crap.
It's funny you should bring that up, Steve, because on this day in history, the 23rd of August, 1305, Sir William Wallace was convicted of treason and drawn and quartered.
It what?
Was pretty brutal. He was found guilty at Westminster Hall. And immediately afterwards, he was taken to the Tower of London, stripped naked, dragged through the city behind a horse. He was then hanged, but before he actually died from the hanging, they cut him down, emasculated him, eviscerated him, had his bowels burnt while he was still alive, and then finally beheaded him, and then cut him into several parts, sending his limbs to far-off cities, and tarring his head and putting it on a pike on top of London Bridge.
And then they tortured him.
So when you they say emasculated him?
They did.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did they call him? Like a little girl? Like, what did they do?
They removed his penis and testicles.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, when they emasculated dudes, they were serious about it.
Like, back then, that was some real, you know, they weren't kidding around.
Yeah. So if you've seen the movie Braveheart, you did not see that, I think.
You saw nothing, like, they alluded saw nothing to like reality.
They alluded to that. They definitely showed his face as somebody went busy down there. Yeah,
tore his intestines out or something. Yeah.
But I thought it would be fun to talk about because it's been a long time since I've seen the movie Braveheart, but I remembered it being a complete bastardization of historical fact. So I wanted to mention a couple of the things that were wrong with it.
Welcome to the movies.
No. You misunderstand. This wasn't your average, you know, film
embellishments,
taking,
right?
Yeah. Taking a bit of liberty with a story. This was really hilariously bad, and historians of the era by and large consider Braveheart to be one of the most historically inaccurate films ever created.
Wait a second. Very important question coming up. Did the king throw the guy out the window? Yes or no?
Out the window. No.
Oh, come on.
No.
Kidding me.
He defenestrate him?
No one was defenestrated as far as I know.
Did William Wallace, did he, after they killed his wife, did he single-handedly go in and kill everyone in the fort?
No. Although history does suggest, you know, and remember that he lived a very long time ago, so a lot of facts are still in dispute. But it is suggested by historical sources that his wife at one point was killed, and he killed the sheriff of a town in retribution. So, close.
All right, here's an easy one. They wore kilts, right?
Okay, no.
What?
Wait a minute. It's Scotland.
No. Kilts came 500 years later.
500.
And... what's even more funny is that when kilts eventually came along, they were worn in a completely different style.
Like on their head? What'd they do?
with no underpants. No, yeah, I guess they were backwards in the film. So one historian, Sharon Crossa, said, she compared the inaccuracy to a film about colonial America showing the colonial men wearing 20th century business suits, but with the jackets worn back to front instead of the right way around.
Yeah, that was my favorite line in the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, there were no, belted plaids until the 16th century. And also, Mel Gibson's character, William Wallace, is painted with woad, you know, those blue yeah. lines on his face, and that was from about 1,000 years earlier. 1,000 years.
Yeah, it's all in the past, you know.
Let's not argue over
Ukiyo-e. Now that we're talking about it, uh-huh. So he made that movie. He also made The Passion of Christ. Now, did he screw up everything in there? Like, was Christ actually wearing a kilt in reality?
The other funny thing I wanted to mention about Braveheart, the other funny historical inaccuracy is that in the film, the big love story is between William Wallace and Isabella of France. And, at the actual time that this all happened, she was a child. And in fact, she was 3 years old, and living in France by the time he, won his great battle.
So he was literally robbing the cradle there, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And like the film has a whole subplot about her like getting pregnant and, you know, all that stuff. So yeah, that definitely did not happen. And then of course there are a lot of, you know, people left out and some of the things that, you know, you might find a little more forgivable when you're trying to streamline complex historical, you know, fact mm-hmm. into a 2 hour long movie. But yeah, by and large it was, crazy inaccurate.
All right, but there is something cool that we could take away from this.
Yeah.
All right, now keep in mind, I know he's crazy, right? You know, he's
Mel.
Yeah, he's got yeah. issues or whatever.
Only when he's drunk.
But he did, I mean, if all that stuff didn't actually happen historically that he didn't have to pull from, he wrote a kick-ass movie. That's impressive.
Well, he didn't write the movie.
Oh,
that's another
screenplay.
He directed
historical
it.
Inaccuracy.
He directed it. Writer was another guy named Wallace, but I don't know if he's
Randall Wallace.
So yeah, Mel Gibson was just the director.
Okay. Well, don't say just. That's a hard job.
Well, yeah, he was director and producer. Randall Wallace was the writer.
Right. They should just put at the beginning of the movie, this took place in an alternate universe, maybe.
Right.
Maybe.
Asterisk. Any resemblance to a real living or dead William Wallace is purely coincidental.
So, Jay.
Yes.
I want to know about robot swarms.
When do we need to bow down?
All right. So, in the past, when scientists created an interactive swarm of tiny little robots, they were only able to get about, 200 robots in coordination? And believe me, that's no small feat. I'm not trying to diminish that. But, however, Harvard scientists have been able to create a swarm, and they got it up to 1,000 robots. Now, when we say a swarm, I'm talking about them acting together, like, you know, as one or in coordination. Now, this is...
Maybe it should be called a flock.
There you go.
No, swarm is much better.
Swarm of robots, not a flock of robots.
How about a murder of robots?
No, that's more appropriate.
You're jumping ahead. Let me get to that part.
Okay, all right. Sorry.
Okay, so... That is the biggest robot swarm to date, and this is an epic feat. Why? Because of all the coordination, right? It's complicated. You have all these machines moving around, and they have to somehow be told what to do and how to interact with each other without having it be a big hot mess. So you see thousands of birds. Everyone's seen like the crazy bird swarm thing on YouTube, or bees doing some crazy coordinated movements flying around, or the, you know, you ever see like a swarm shuffle where they're like on a tree. Or they're on a bush or whatever, and you could see them kind of move, like there's like sound waves kind of moving through the swarm, which is really cool.
Are you fish, talking about bees or birds?
Bees. Okay. Fish, you know, of course, it's easy to see huge groups of fish swimming in coordination.
Schools.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca just schooled you, Jay.
Good one, Steve.
Yeah, and then you've also seen maybe buffalo or other big land animals do this type of coordinated movement. Now, all of these animals got to be able to do this, not because they were practicing, it's evolution, right? So evolution throughout millions of years, you know, they were able to develop ways to move around and understand how to, you know, read body language, whatever, water pressure, all the different things, you know, you want to throw in there that could be the possible communication that giant groups of animals would have with each other. But of course, these robots are not doing it that way. Scientists had to come up with a completely new way to have these little machines move around without completely wrecking each other. Keeping all that in mind, don't get scared, Evan, right? Because I know that you're thinking about this.
Just paranoid, that's all.
The robot swarm is actually pretty insignificant. They had a penny next to one of them, but they're more like about the size of a quarter each. They only cost $14. They're really not that big of a deal. They're not complicated robots at all. All they can really do is communicate and vibrate. Keep this in mind. They have three legs.
And move. Well,
yeah, well, the vibrations helps them move. They have three legs. They've been described as like toothpick-like, or, you know, like they look like tiny 10-penny nail or whatever, little, you know, little straight, stiff metal leg coming down. And these legs allow the robot to move themselves by a slight vibration, and the vibrations cause them to, you know, jiggle a little bit, and they can kind of control the direction that they move in, so they could actually move in coordination. So in a demonstration, the robots are able to form basic shapes like, what, you know, letters and stars or whatever. And, you know, it's kind of like what you see at a sporting event. You know, remember, I think in the last Olympics or whatever, you know, any Super Bowl, you see a bunch of like cheerleaders out and they're walking around, and all of a sudden, like, you see the face of a famous person, or they form some letters or some type of design. That's pretty much what they're doing. And, you know, if you think about, you know, there's probably thousands of people on a football field that are making those shapes. To briefly give you a description of how it works, four of the robots will go out and lead and kind of take key positions in the shape that they're about to make. And then the rest of the robots just simply kind of fill in the area. That's a really oversimplification of it, because we're dealing with very complicated algorithms that are being communicated out, or instructions are being communicated out to each one of the robots simultaneously, you know, and they're moving only in two dimensions. That makes it a lot easier. They're essentially on a slick surface. And that's why when they vibrate, they can move very easily across that slick surface. But they're not going up and down. They're just going, you know, in two dimensions on a flat surface. I know what you're thinking. How soon until these robots come and kill everybody in one big coordinated cheerleading-like catastrophe, right?
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Mm. It would be cool if they did yell out cheers as they were moving together, right?
Yeah.
One of the applications that they could use to do this is for driverless cars, right? So, you know, there could be hundreds or thousands of driverless cars close to each other. And let's say in the future, there's other autonomous robot-like vehicles or whatever. Could be anything. Could be like a little mailbox that, you know, picks up mail and goes around. Well, all of these things are going to have to not only navigate around busy streets and all that with people and everything, but all the other things that are moving around. So this type of research and development of this technology could be very useful for, you know, it could be, you know, 10 or 15 years from now when we see stuff like that. Driverless cars are on the way. This is going to get really useful when things start to move in three dimensions. So I would say that this research is fantastic. We absolutely need it for a lot of other technology that's being developed right now. Now, Bob and I love to talk about what, Bob?
Nanomachines!
Nanomachines! Thank you!
Woohoo!
Now, if you think about this, all right, so really quickly, a nanomachine, we're talking about a microscopic machine that could have very useful little appendages that could do things. So imagine a scientist is standing in front of a clear pane of glass looking into an aircraft carrier-sized laboratory. He presses some buttons and the room fills up with a milky-like liquid filled with raw material. The nanomachines then get injected in there, and they're just swarming around and they're picking up raw material, and they start assembling a rocket ship. And then, you know, they're just grabbing the raw material as it passes by, and they're all coordinated effort. They're building things and connecting with each other and connecting these molecules together. And over a period of time, the remaining liquid drains out of the room, and there's a finished spaceship all done, ready to go. And that whole process maybe takes an hour. And the one scientist made it happen with a set of, you know, of construction blueprints that were in the computer.
Yeah, utility fog is just kind of like the far end of the spectrum if you extrapolate this. A smaller step would be using these algorithms to have, say, a million cars navigate on highways and back roads and coordinate their movements so they don't hit each other. And then from there, you could step that up into programmable matter, that's much more sophisticated and much smaller. You could have prototypes, you know, create themselves so you could evaluate them. And then utility fog is just the next step where it's called polymorphic material. Basically, it's these little supercomputers with these extendable arms. So they'd be like octahedron shaped with like 12 of these extendable arms that go out that can latch on to other such devices. And once they latch together, they can communicate. They could actually create force. You're talking about cell sized devices here. They could change their electrical properties, their optical properties. They could change color, texture, shape, and who knows how long it's going to take. But I hope I see a glimmer of it before I die, because could you just imagine what if your house or your room was made out of this stuff?
I probably got one big problem with what you said.
Yeah, go for it.
If they have 12 arms, it would be a dodecahedron, not an octahedron.
Mm. Well, depending on
your whole premise is flawed. I can't.
Okay, it all just collapses.
It all collapses.
Good catch, but I mean the arms can come out of anywhere, though, right? They don't have to come out of a vertice,
but why would you a face? But why would you have 12 arms and not have it be a dodecahedron?
I'm really disappointed, Bob.
Jay, I want to get back to something you said. Also, a little nitpick before we get emails. The cheerleader thing really isn't a good analogy. I mean, visually it might be, but the difference is that, like with the cheerleaders, they're all going, each individual person knows where they're supposed to go.
Yeah.
With the swarm of robots, to be clear, they're just following a simple algorithm and the complex behavior emerges out of that.
Oh yeah, I meant visually, like when you see them move around.
Yeah, just to be clear. Yeah, just by
mimicking.
We don't
want any
visually
angry cheerleaders writing in claiming that we're saying that they don't operate with independent intelligences.
But and you know, obviously, it's fun to speculate about this kind of technology. But you are leapfrogging many, many.
Oh come on! I know we're
generations
of course.
Technology.
I mean, we're having this is part of like our. It's part sci-fi in a way too. I mean, we know it's possible. Sure,
yeah,
someday,
99
maybe.
Parts sci-fi. You
know. Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, this is the far end of the spectrum of what's possible. But it's something that that's just fun to think about. It's not.
Yeah, but having a programmable house would be cool.
Missions to Mars would be a cakewalk. You know, you barely don't need to bring much. The machines could just build it out of the materials that are there.
From science fiction to perhaps one of the worst science news reporting I have seen in a long time.
What?
Oh, man.
Always saying something.
Yeah, you were like, the bile was spewing, Steve, when you wrote this.
Oh, it really rubbed me the wrong way. Just because the sheer incompetence of the science reporting was unbelievable. So here's the lead paragraph. Landmark Adelaide research showing that sperm and eggs appear to carry genetic memories of events well before conception may force a rethink of the evolutionary theories of Charles Darwin, scientists what? Say. Almost every concept in that sentence is incorrect. So first of all, they are not referring to research, but to a review article. It's not even like a systematic review. It's not even a study. It's just a comment. You know, it's researchers writing a review about epigenetics. It's not research, you know, let alone Landmark.
So what is it?
It also, Landmark. You'll know, what struck me is I read the whole paper and there isn't a mention of Charles Darwin or evolution in the paper.
Or epigenetics, correct?
Or no, the paper. The paper is about epigenetics.
The
news article doesn't mention epigenetics. The review article that the news article is covering doesn't mention Darwin or Lamarck or evolution. It's almost as if they're writing about two completely different things.
That's what
you know. It's like one of those things where did the author? You know, where did the journalist? Who is a guy named Brad Crouch. Where did Crouch even get this from? I don't know how he got to his article from the paper that he is allegedly writing about.
It seemed like he had an agenda.
Yeah, so here, well, I don't know. I don't know. He could.
It's just confused.
Either there's an agenda or it was like he was doing that journalist thing. Just let me search for a hook or for an angle and then let me go with that, even though he completely made it up. This is what the paper actually says. Transgenerational epigenetic effects interact with conditions at conception to program the developmental trajectory of the embryo and fetus, ultimately affecting the lifetime health of the child. These insights compel us to revise generally held notions to accommodate the prospect that biological parenting commences well before birth, even prior to conception. Again, no mention of Darwin or evolution or anything like that. Epigenetics is an interesting concept. It's actually been around for, you guys know how long epigenetics has been around for?
It's like a century?
Three generations.
I'd say 50 years.
Yeah, 50 years. And the term was coined in the 1930s. The modern concept of epigenetics has been around since at least the 1970s. So again, this review article is hardly a landmark or anything new, but it has really taken off in the last, I would say, 10 or 20 years. And that the notion is that while genetic information, you know, determines proteins, and obviously proteins are enzymes and structural, and they pretty much determine, you know, how organisms look and function and behave. But epigenetic factors can affect the expression of genes, like how much of a protein is being made. So those are factors that are outside of the genes. You know, that's why they're epigenetic. Again, not a shocking concept if you understand anything about genetics. And also, I mean, it's all, again, it's also like this guy was a journalist writing 100 years ago, or even like 70 or 80 years ago, when, you know, when we had a very immature notion or simplistic notion of what genetics were and how they functioned. But of course, you know, genetics interact with the environment. This is related to another concept, and here the authors, the scientists who wrote the review article, they have a little bit of blame in that, a very small amount though. They used the metaphor of a blueprint, that genes are a blueprint. And that's actually a little inaccurate, because genes are not a blueprint. A blueprint is a representation of the final product, right? Genes do not have a representation of what the final organism looks like. Genes are a recipe. They're a list of instructions that if you follow them, the final product will emerge out of that. That distinction's important for a number of ways to actually understand how genes work. For example, the information contained in a newborn child's brain vastly exceeds the information in the genome, let alone just the genes that code for brain proteins. How does that happen? Well, a blueprint obviously can't do that, right? A blueprint contains all the information, at least schematically, that is in the final product. But just like we were talking about with the robot swarm, right, Jay? If you follow a simple rule of instructions, more greater complexity can emerge out of that. And our genes function the same way. It lists the rules that cells follow as they develop, and that following those rules results in far greater complexity and information. And our brain is just the best example of that. And of course, that's interacting with the environment, including other cells, you know, chemical gradients and all sorts of stuff. It's not surprising. And now there's, you know, lots of experimental studies showing that how genes unfold in their program and how they are expressed is influenced by environmental factors, including the habits of the parents. So there are several studies which show, for example, that if the mother has access to a lot of food, that's a signal of abundance, and their offspring will have a bigger appetite. You know, so they're already a little pre-adapted to, you know, the situation that there's an abundance of food. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, if the mother is lean, then epigenetic influences will, you know, program the offspring to have a decreased appetite, to, you know, get away with less food. So that kind of thing makes sense. It's kind of like a little short-term tweak on the expression of genes that are influenced by the, you know, environmental factors of the time. It doesn't actually circumvent genetics or override genetics. It doesn't really have a dramatic influence on the course of evolution but this guy Crouch, this journalist, is saying that this means Lamarck was right.
Oh Lord.
The inheritance of acquired characteristics. And now that's good. We're going to go back to Lamarckian evolution and replace Darwinian evolution.
Oh boy.
Ugh.
Well, it's not going to happen, pal. Let's start by saying that.
And the Earth is a cube. It's not,
and
it's not a sphere.
The other thing that really annoyed me, and this is, again, something I get annoyed with at bad journalism in general, is, you know, doing the whole thing where you have your narrative and then you interview a scientist and you just mine for quotes that you can pull out of context and plug into whatever narrative you already decided you're going to write.
Like the Discovery Channel.
Like Discovery Channel. So he has all these quotes from one of the authors of the review article that could be made to seem like they're supporting his narrative, but she never specifically mentions anything that he's talking about. She's just talking about epigenetics, about what I just described, but never mentions anything about evolution or Darwin or Lamarck or, you know, anything like that. You know, she writes, for example, like, people used to think that it didn't matter because a child represented a new beginning with a fresh start. It's like, okay, now we know that some of the behaviors of parents can have an impact on their kids. Okay. But that's what she's talking about, not anything about evolution. But he uses her quotes to make it seem like she's supporting this drivel that he's reporting. Very disappointing.
It sounds like a creationist tactic almost. I don't want to say this guy necessarily has an agenda. I just think he's hopelessly confused. But
yeah, I think it's basically, just, I think it's just bad journalism. I agree.
Did the scientist he quote mind weigh in on this?
I haven't heard anything about it, no. I mean, you can always get blindsided by a journalist who's going to do this to you, but, you know, you also have to develop the skill as a scientist of how to talk to the media to minimize this happening. Like in my experience, you know, being interviewed, you know, the times that I have, you have to get a feel for what is the narrative, the producer, or in this case, the journalist, what's the story they're telling? And sometimes, you know, you get the distinct impression that anything, I'm not changing their mind about anything, you know?
Yeah, you're just a prop.
I'm just a prop, yeah. The other thing is, you know, it is disappointing too, because epigenetics is kind of a new scientific concept in terms of the public consciousness. I know it's been around for decades, but I don't think that there's much public awareness of epigenetics. I think most people probably have no idea what it is. And so, you know, here's a science journalist essentially introducing this concept to a lot of people and getting it completely wrong. You know, so anyone reading this article is going to be completely misinformed about what epigenetics is.
Yeah, that's too bad.
All right, but none of this matters because our entire universe, right, Bob, is just is inside a black hole or something.
Bob? Well, no, or something. Yes, you were correct with or something. So, do you guys hate the Big Bang Theory? Not the TV show.
Yes.
The theory, the theory about the creation of the universe. Some scientists, it appears, claims that they have a potential workaround. They say that they have the math to support the theory that a hyperdimensional star in a five-dimensional universe gave birth to our universe. Yes, you heard it right. Uh-huh. A hyperdimensional star, well, a black hole in a five-dimensional universe gave birth to our universe. That's what they're saying.
Okay.
Astronomer Fred Hoyle, I don't know if you know that, coined the term Big Bang over a century ago. You know, yeah, our entire universe came from an explosion of space and time from a singularity, which is a point of infinite density and temperature, right? So, yeah, that sounds pretty crazy. But it has tremendous utility, though. Eventually, it took a little while, but it accounts for a host of observations like the cosmic microwave background radiation, the afterglow of the Big Bang, the structure of the universe at its largest scales, so the amounts of light elements like hydrogen, helium. Some other things, were problematic, like the horizon problem just means that the temperature across the universe is too uniform. The flatness problem, our universe is just way too flat. It would have to be fine-tuned to within one part in 100 trillion at the beginning of the universe to explain why it's still so flat. The whole magnetic monopole thing. The theory predicts that there should be lots of them, but we're not seeing them. So, but they took care of all of that with cosmic inflation, you know, the hyper expansion of the universe early on, really fast, but very brief, that kind of flattened everything out and took care of all those things. So that was nice, but it's kind of like tacked on. I mean, I like that theory, but it, you know, it's pretty amazing thing to postulate. Oh, well, maybe we just had this incredible expansion for a very fraction of a second that took care of all of our problems and then stopped by itself. But there's other problems too. Just the whole idea of a singularity that preceded the Big Bang is a problem. You know, imagine the singularity containing the entire universe squished into a ball smaller than the head of a pin. The laws of physics inside there just said, F this crap. And you can't do anything. You can't predict anything inside of there. So how does our universe, our predictable, well-ordered universe come from something like that? So these scientists from the Perimeter Institute, they think that they could, they have a way around this singularity and cosmic expansion problem, or inflation. They say that the universe may have been created, on the outside of a five-dimensional singularity in another universe. Five dimensions, that's four spatial and one temporal. So if like a four-dimensional black hole, essentially. So this theorized universe was similar, but has this one extra spatial dimension. But these guys, they did the math. They did their homework. So it's not just, they're not just pulling this out of nowhere. They use the math that we use to describe space-time in our universe. And that also apparently includes these holographic tools that they can use to translate events that occur in one set of dimensions into another. So from 4D to 3D, for example. And when you do that, you can kind of see how that extra or less dimension will affect what transpires. And, you know, dealing with higher dimensions is pretty trivial in mathematics. You could pretty much do whatever, an arbitrary number of dimensions, really. The question is, though, is do these dimensions exist? Are they really there? Here's a way to describe what they think happened. Imagine a four-dimensional, if you can, imagine a four-dimensional star collapsing to form a black hole. Somehow the debris ejected from that process becomes incorporated somehow into this 3D brain, B-R-A-N-E, around the event horizon of the singularity. This is how our universe began, according to this theory. And then this brain would start expanding, the expansion of our universe. And when we look at our universe, we kind of interpret it as this big bang from a singularity. But actually that's not what they're saying. So this is a good analogy then to a normal 3D black hole, right? That we all know and love in our universe. They form a 2D spherical surface, the event horizon around itself. So this would be, if you go up one dimension, it creates a three-dimensional hypersphere around the four-dimensional singularity. So then our universe would be just this wrapper, a three-dimensional wrapper around the event horizon of a four-dimensional black hole. So that's pretty much what they're saying. So the idea then is that this does away with the problems with the singularities, since our universe would never have been inside of one. So it kind of does away with that problem. And it also apparently handles, you don't need cosmic inflation to handle the horizon problem and all those other problems, because the technicalities of four-dimensional birth explains them away, apparently. That's what they're saying in a nutshell.
Does it make any predictions that would distinguish it from the Big Bang?
Actually, it does make some predictions, but they say that there would be cosmic, some characteristic fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background radiation that we're not seeing. But those predictions aren't very useful. As far as I could tell, the predictions it makes wouldn't be able to distinguish this theory from 1,000 other similar theories. But there's some serious red flags, though, besides a practical lack of prediction, which they would probably disagree with. They think that they can make predictions, but there's other serious red flags. This paper was published on the archive server over a year ago. And in all that time, nobody has cited it, the authors included. And that's a red flag.
Why is it just hitting the headlines now?
That's a good question. I couldn't figure that out that either. It could be a sign of desperation. Hey, I want to get we need some attention on this. Let's try to get people talking about it. That's a possibility. That's also not a good sign at all. And also another thing, this isn't even very original. This is really, ultimately, this is a minor follow-up to a popular paper that had over 200 citations that describes what they call the DGP model. And actually, the authors of the paper I've been talking about, they refer to this over and over in their paper. They're just totally upfront about it. So their model, this genuine model that people are excited about and has been cited over and over, they don't talk about the Big Bang or doing away with it, or what they describe in their paper is a four-dimensional gravity on a 3D brain in 5D space. Which, does sound familiar? I mean, this is pretty much what these guys are talking about, but they add some little extra stuff to it about the 3D brain around the event horizon of a 4D singularity, doing away with the black hole and all that stuff. And
so we have to rename the TV show now and call it the Hyperdimensional Star in the Five-Dimension Universe.
Sheldon would love it.
All right, well, that straightens that all up. that out.
Does it though?
But what's even cooler than that, though, Evan, is that finally somebody got a picture of the man on the moon.
Oh, we've heard about it for a long time. I mean, ever since we were growing up as kids, we've heard the phrase, man on the moon, right? When you hear those four words put together, maybe it conjures up an image in your brain, such as Neil Armstrong taking that jump out of the Eagle and touching his feet to the moon's surface. Or, Steve, as you alluded, some people might think of the phrase man in the moon referring to the apparent face we see when we look up at the full moon, the whitish gray orb, and the darker areas sort of, you know, eyes, nose, putting the pieces together as if Picasso sort of put it together. But thanks to the media's inability to properly conduct themselves, we get to read headlines this past week, such as the following. Does a Google Moon NASA image show an alien and its shadow? Or this one. The man on the moon, shadow resembling an alien-like figure captured beside craters on the lunar surface. And then we have moonwalking alien mystery as space picture shows strange figure on surface. I think that the editors don't believe that there's a creature or any sort of thing like it, man-sized or otherwise, on the moon. But hey, you know, headlines are headlines and you gotta capture people's attentions. That's their mindset. But thank goodness for people like Phil Plait, who, as usual, does the heavy lifting to correct all the misinformation and misperceptions that the mainstream media refuses to do. And here is Phil's headline over at Slate.com. No, Google Moon doesn't show an alien loitering on the moon. Thank you, Dr. Plait. So what's all this about, then? Well, there's an image that's making the rounds on the information superhighway, courtesy of Google Moon, which is, you know, a virtual map of the moon, basically. And someone happened to spot something which looks sort of like a person in a shadow. And your brain can kind of make out a head, shoulders, and maybe as a biped upright in mid-stride. You know, that's kind of the first thing maybe you see. And yeah, it was first uploaded as part of a YouTube clip by YouTube user Wow For Real, and it's gotten over 500,000 views. And he wrote, it looks like it could be a cast shadow from a massive standing object or figure. This is not the first time Wow For Real has used Google Moon images to talk about. In January, he showed some controversial images believed to be a secret spaceship or alien base on the moon. So this is kind of goes with him, his MO. But what is it really? What are we really looking at? According to Phil Plait, you can start by debunking the apparent shadow that it's casting. Phil notes that the crater to the left of the image casts a shadow in an entirely different direction. So the apparent shadow is, guess what, not a shadow at all. So if there's no shadow, then it serves to reason that what we are looking at is something that is not on the surface of the moon. Digital artifact, perhaps, something like that. Phil mentioned in his original blog post that the images used for the Google Moon were taken from a project called the Clementine Mission, 1994, a Navy related project in which they did a survey of the moon. But that was 20 years ago. And as Phil later found out and made an addendum to his article, Google Moon uses images from a wider variety of sources. Some of the images date back as far as, well, 1971, the Apollo 15 mission. And that's when this particular picture was taken. So now what we're dealing with is an image from 43 years ago, you know, and the technology to have captured the image. Not exactly the pinnacle of space photography, quite the contrary. So it's not a digital artifact, rather it's an analog artifact. More specifically, it's a piece of dust on the lens. And how were we able to figure that out? Well, you got to give credit where credit's due. It was pointed out by one of the message board participants at metabunk.org. His handle is Trailblazer, so Trailblazer writes the following. This particular frame is from the mapping camera on Apollo 15 back in 1971. The camera was part of the scientific instrument module mounted on the service module, which remained in orbit around the moon while the lunar module landed on the moon. The mapping camera took around 2,000 images of the lunar surface, and every single one of the images features the object in the same area of the frame. It is a piece of debris, hair, fluff, dust, whatever, the optics of the camera, likely held close to the film plane as it is fairly sharp and appears to cast a shadow.
Yeah, somebody was saying it probably wasn't on the lens, but in the internal mechanism to be that sharp.
It's in the camera, though, because right. It was on every frame. It's obviously something in the camera.
It's pretty cool that someone was able to actually trace that down to the exact camera that was used and figure that out.
Yeah, I agree.
Good investigation.
Very cool. Very good investigation. And hey, you know, where have we seen this before, right? Where a piece of dust or a hair or something could be responsible for seeing something in a picture that's not really there. Gee, we see this all the time. Bugs are mistaken for aliens. Camera cords or water droplets in the air are mistaken for ghosts. And occasionally dust and other particles in space look like either UFOs or, in this case, a humanoid on the surface of the moon. Mystery solved. Editors of mainstream media need not apply.
Well, guys, we have a new sponsor this week, Stamps.com.
Oh, man, I hate going to the post office more than anything. And so anything that can keep me out of the post office, I'm excited about.
What about the DMV?
I hate that, too, but I don't think anybody's come up with driverslicenses.com.
You might be right.
But stamps.com can actually keep you out of the post office because anything you can do there, you can do at your desk with stamps.com.
Yeah, all you need is a printer. Any printer will do. You don't need special ink or anything. And any computer-like device that can print. And then you can go online for just $15.99 a month. You could print your own postage. Of course, it also costs the cost of postage.
Yeah, and you could do that around the clock, right? So, you know, if you're running a business and you find yourself having to go to the post office every day or multiple times a week, with stamps.com, you simply just print the postage that you need 24/7.
Yeah, I remember using those old postage meters and stuff, and you had to do a long-term commitment with those. But you don't need to do that for stamps.com. It's just $15.99 a month plus the cost of postage, like Steve said.
We still have a stamp meter at our office, but I'm going to recommend to our office that we go ahead and get stamps.com. Plus, right now, use our promo code SGU for this special offer. Here it is. It's a no-risk trial, a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale up to $55 worth of free postage. So do not wait. Don't wait. Do it now.
Yeah, so go to stamps.com. Then click on the microphone at the top of the page and type in SGU, and you'll get our special offer.
And you won't get that glue all over your tongue.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, well, we are going to finish up our news segment with a mystery that I don't think we're going to solve, and that's also a little sad. We just mentioned, kind of alluded last week to the fact that we recorded the show right after hearing that Robin Williams had committed suicide. Well, Rebecca, you're going to tell us about some internet theories about what's going on.
Yeah, there have been a lot flying around, and it's really horrifically disgraceful, as it is every time a celebrity dies and people use it as a hook to talk about whatever their particular pet theory is. And of course, you know, this has inspired a lot of really good discussion about what Robin Williams actually died from, which is depression. And, you know, talking about some important facts about depression, like the best way to report on it in the mainstream media, and talking about how Robin Williams was in the one of the largest and growing demographics for suicide, and talking about how we can stop that from happening. So at the same time, we have all these great conversations happening. We have Rob Schneider doing the opposite. I don't know if we've talked about Schneider before, but we blogged about him on Skeptic a few years back because he went on the radio talking about how the government uses vaccines to control the populace, and he has opinions. Okay,
mm-hmm. Yeah, he has opinions on cloning too. You know, making cupcakes.
Oh God,
good nice, one. Dude, nice.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, which if you don't know who Rob Schneider is, congratulations, you're a better person than most. He is the quote-unquote comedian who is the star of such vehicles as Deuce Bigelow, American Gigolo or something, Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo. Uh-huh. Some really high-quality stuff.
I liked him in The Stapler.
The Stapler?
The Stapler.
I don't know. Is that a joke?
That's a South Park reference.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Rob Schneider is the stapler.
I
never remember
that. That's good, Steve. Very good.
So now he is once again in the news because he is tweeting using the Robin Williams hashtag, saying, "Now that we can talk about it, Robin Williams was on a drug treating the symptoms of Parkinson's. One of the side effects is suicide." All in caps, that last bit. and follow that up with the evil pharmaceutical industry admits to over 100,000 people in the USA die a year from prescription drugs. Exclamation point, hashtag Robin Williams. So,
and evil is capitalized, which I don't quite understand, but whatever.
Yeah, and pharmaceutical industry isn't. He's not a big one for grammar, I suppose. But
how many does he claim died?
100,000.
From what, over though? From any prescription drugs?
It took me a while to... He says 100,000 people in the USA die a year from, quote-unquote, prescription drugs. It took me a while to dig up the citation, because when I Googled that, it just led me down a rabbit hole of natural news, Joseph Mercola sort of conspiracy theory websites. But eventually I found one conspiracy theory website that actually linked to what they said was the study, but which was actually a commentary written in the Journal of the American Medical Association. But the author of that commentary cited the same statistic and linked to the actual source. So I was able to look at the study. It's incidence of adverse drug reactions in hospitalized patients. It was a meta-analysis that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association 15 years ago. I looked it up, and, you know, it is what the conclusion they came to. They were looking specifically at hospitalized patients. That's worth noting. They weren't looking at the average person on the street. So they were looking at, you know, generally very ill people. And yeah, they estimated a mean value of 106,000 fatalities due to adverse drug reactions, or ADRs. So, you know, side effects and things like that. Medicines, you know, causing these side effects that could result in death. And the lower limit that they figured was 76,000 fatalities. And even at the lower number, that is a huge number of people. That would rank as the sixth leading cause of death in the US if it were true. I wasn't able to find much follow-up on this, and maybe our listeners can succeed where I failed. I'll keep looking this week. But
well, Rebecca, Harry Hall actually wrote a review of that on Science Based Medicine. It's unfortunate that your Google search didn't lead to that article.
Yeah, no, I didn't see it.
Not ranking high enough, I guess. But she deconstructs it nicely, so you could read that article if you're interested. I guess I'll add it to the show notes. But the bottom line is that that's not considering risk versus benefit.
Yes, exactly.
You know, so you have to consider, as you correctly observe, we're talking about a very sick population. How many of those people would have died without drug therapy? How many people were saved because of drug therapy? You know, when people are sick, you have to do higher and higher risk things, right? You know, when people are on death's door, you'll do higher risk interventions, because if you don't, they're going to die. And so technically, while that may be, you know, narrowly technically true that a drug complication contributed to death in these people, that, that doesn't mean that there are 100,000 excess deaths due to pharmaceuticals.
Right.
You know,
and it's absolutely worth pointing out that this number is, even though it's being misrepresented by people like Rob Schneider, it is a huge number compared to other industrialized nations. And so it is a concern that many doctors and researchers have brought up in ensuing years, saying, look, we need to talk about how we can fix this, and making changes to the FDA, things like improving the safety experts on the advisory committees, or giving the FDA more legal authority to stop certain violations that might be happening. There are a number of steps that can be taken to reduce that number. But yes, it's being completely misrepresented by these people, ignoring things like, that these are ill people who are taking certain risks.
And yes, you're right. The real point of that article was quality control, not drugs are bad, or not even drugs are dangerous. It's just hospitals are complicated, dangerous places that are taking care of people who are very sick, and there's a very small margin of error. And we need, systems in place that reduce error in hospitals. or reduce risk in hospitals as much as possible. So it's all about risk control, not about evil pharmaceutical industry. So it's a totally right. abused statistic.
So, and all of that aside, as far as I can tell, and maybe Steve, you can weigh in on this as a doctor. I looked into, you know, as far as I can tell, there's no public information about Robin Williams specifically. You know, his wife, released the news that he had Parkinson's and, but not much more, not any information about what medications he was on. But, you know, I accept that maybe Rob Schneider knows the family. He might have some inside info. So I snooped around, and as best I can find, none of the Parkinson's drugs have any increased risk of suicide.
Okay. So no, that's not true. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I tried to find out any information about what drug he was on, and I couldn't. You know, I found 100. No exaggeration, news reports about this, because if you search for like Parkinson's suicide, you get articles about this, about Schneider's comments. But anyway, they all were just repeating the same basic two pieces of information. You know, these tweets and Robin Williams' wife essentially saying he had early Parkinson's disease and he was not ready to discuss it publicly. And that's it. No mention of what medications he was on. We also know that he was suffering from depression and anxiety, and he was being treated for those entities as well. He had some recent relapse into drug use, but was apparently not abusing at that moment, you know, that he killed himself. But in any case, there was one drug called Sinemet, which is levodopa-carbidopa, which there are case reports of suicide on this medication. What it does is, you know, it increases the availability of dopamine. Dopamine is what's missing in patients with Parkinson's disease. But the problem is that dopamine is used in different parts of the brain for different reasons. So this is an oversimplification, but basically if you increase dopamine, that will treat the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, but it increases symptoms of psychosis. And anti-dopamine drugs will treat psychosis but cause Parkinsonism. You know, so there's
right.
kind of yeah, a push-pull kind of situation.
Which medication was that?
Sinemet is the brand name, and levodopa carbidopa is the generic name.
So that's the one that's actually converted into dopamine in the brain?
Yeah, the levodopa is converted yeah. to dopamine in the brain.
Yeah, see, that's the one that's the most common treatment, and I looked through all the side effects and I didn't see anything about suicide.
Yeah, it's listed, and I looked on PubMed and I couldn't find any specific statistics on levodopa. I only found some case reports with dopamine agonists, and it does, you know, there are the two effects that could potentially contribute to suicide. One is impulse control.
Right.
You know, people yeah. acting on their impulses. And the other is suicidal ideation, is actual suicidal thoughts.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, that's the one I couldn't yeah, find.
Which
I
is kind of related to the psychosis thing, you know.
The impulse control one I've found, but I still, you know, I saw that it was listed as hypersexuality or compulsive gambling. But I can see, you know, I could see at a stretch how that could yeah. lead to suicide, particularly because depression is a symptom of Parkinson's, but apparently having Parkinson's doesn't increase your risk of suicide as far as the studies I read show. And it's suspected that that's because the Parkinson's also comes with a decreased interest in taking risks. And so it kind of balances out in a way. So I can see a medication that causes an increase in risk taking.
Yeah. Yeah. So the bottom line is there's a theoretical concern. It's something that you watch for when you initiate treatment with it, but the risk is very low and there are very few actual reported cases. And of course, you never know if the drug actually played a role because, as you say, people, you know, they're depressed. They have depression, you know, as like an organic depression. And then they're also depressed about having Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, and apparently that's one of the problems with diagnosing Parkinson's and also treating someone with Parkinson's, because when they are depressed, it's difficult to tell if that's something that's being caused by the Parkinson's or just being caused by the diagnosis of Parkinson's. Yeah,
exactly.
But yeah, it's infuriating to me. And, you know, Rob Schneider is hardly the only person to do this. It's just the most recent one that happened before this show. But there's... And people jump to make all of these assumptions in order to support whatever it is they want to rant about.
Yeah.
And so I'm using this as ability to rant about people who do that, and I understand the irony of that. But he immediately jumps to this conclusion, several conclusions, that he was on this drug, that it led to his suicide. He doesn't know what Robin Williams was going through. I'm friends with several people who were friends with Williams, and by and large, you know, he was very private about his own struggles. And I can't imagine that he's that Rob Schneider has some sort of insight into Robin Williams' life that other people didn't have, and so he's offering this. It's incredibly disrespectful to both Robin Williams' memory and also to other people who are struggling with depression, when you sort of force your own opinions, you know, when you just sort of make up what must be going on in someone's life to mirror your own opinions, it does them a great disservice and can actually hamper the cause of trying to prevent suicides like this from happening.
Yeah, it's also... generating unnecessary fear among patients with Parkinson's disease who may be on this medication. I mean, he's inserting himself into a fairly complicated medical decision, actually, based upon, you know, his own ignorance and just his, you know, apparent ideology. All right. Well, Evan, let's do Who's That Noisy?
Here is last week's Who's That Noisy, a very painful reminder, if you ask me, but nonetheless, it is protocol. I must play it for you. Here you go.
90% of the psychics working are fakes.
They are.
Well, we're the most documented psychics in the world. And don't go to a psychic unless they have a proven track record of accurate predictions. Seriously, you'll waste your money.
Seriously.
Some good
advice. Is that the psychic twins?
Yeah, it is the psychic twins. You'd think there'd be more of them, but it's just these gals, Linda and Terry Jameson. Identical twins, professionally known as the psychic twins.
She said 90%?
90%.
She's actually off by 9.999 to infinity percent.
I agree.
We'll round it up to 10%.
Wholeheartedly.
Such an insane.
These are two of the people with whom I appeared on the Trisha show 2 years ago, and I got edited out, of course, because they didn't want to hear from the skeptic. They only wanted to hear from Linda and Terry Jameson.
Oh, yeah.
These women are...
That.
I don't know. What, is Vulture 2... harsh, too kind a term is.
So that's, they're just trying to trash their competition, right? Yeah. We're the real psychics. Our competition are fake.
Right.
But if that's true, you know, if their claim that 90% of psychics are fake, you know, and yet the performance is really not any different. You know, people believe in all of those fake psychics. You know, no matter how you slice it, it still undercuts their industry and their credibility. Because then you have to believe that people can be easily falsely convinced that a fake psychic is real. And so it's a short trip to say, well, maybe 100% of them are fake.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
If you look at it rationally, yes. I agree. But, you know, rationality rarely enters the realm of the psychic industry. And, some wrong answers, a few correct answers. And of the correct answers, Nathan Webb, listener Nathan Webb, is this week's winner. Congratulations, Nathan. Well done in detecting the psychic twins for us all.
Good work, sir.
Very well. All right. Who's That Noisy for episode number 476? Wow, 476. 400. Here's this week's Who's That Noisy. Yeah. What you heard was obviously, you know, the Wish You a Merry Christmas song, and someone or something, hint something, decided to key in at the end there with the final note. And you have to figure out exactly what made that noisy.
At the end there. Okay.
At the end. So go ahead, send us your answer. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the official email for all things Who's That Noisy related, or you can post it on our forums, SGUforums.com. Look for the subthread called Who's That Noisy? And I wish you all the very best of luck.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
We're going to do one email. This one comes from Julie Brandon, and Julie writes, I saw an interesting article on Ars Technica discussing the way people take polarized positions based on climate change, based on cultural identity rather than it being an issue of scientific literacy. If this is the case, it would help to better explain some of the problems we see with people taking such extreme sides, often without taking an interest in the evidence, even some self-identified skeptics supporting the skeptical position as a knee-jerk response rather than having used critical thinking. I'm thinking particularly of the many very polarized knee-jerk responses we see in comments on the SGU's Facebook posts. Another in the pot of various cognitive biases, perhaps, for us to remember when considering our own positions. I don't think there's anything fundamentally new. We were aware of both tribal groupthink and biasing responses through the way the questions are asked, but it's great to see more research into this, don't you think? Anyway, keep up the fab work, and here's the article below. And then Julie gives her location as Derby, East Midlands, England, UK, West Europe, Earth, the solar system, outer spiral arm, Milky Way galaxy, local cluster, the observable universe, the metaverse, reality. Just to be thorough.
And why no mention of a supercluster, but that's okay. She's close.
Yeah, enough. She skipped the supercluster. What the hell? Groupthink. Do you think skeptics are...
Guilty.
Guilty of groupthink?
Absolutely.
Yeah, of course.
We're humans.
Skeptics are humans. Yeah, that's what they do.
Since when?
Also, I don't have that much of a problem with a skeptical knee-jerk reaction in a lot of cases. You know, a lot of times you hear something, and I think it's good to have. I think you should have a skeptical default, but you should apply critical thinking, obviously, afterwards. But it's a good reaction to have, I think, in a lot of cases.
So we would characterize that as intuitive versus analytical thinking. Right. So your intuitive response is your quote unquote knee jerk reaction. And it's okay to have that because it's, if you have good intuition, it could be a good first approximation.
Yeah. Starting point.
Yeah. But you have to back it up with the analytical thinking. Right. Mm-hmm. So, that smells like BS. That, you know, if somebody's making a claim that's fantastical, seems to defy the laws of physics, you know, has all the red flags of hokum, it's okay to say, doesn't pass the sniff test. That's my knee-jerk reaction. But you shouldn't stop there, right? A good skeptic would then back it up with some, you know, depending on how important the issue is, would back it up with some analytical approach, looking at, right, what's the evidence show? What's the logic being used here? Let me examine this more closely, and I'll happily refine my opinion based upon a more thorough analytical review. But the other aspect of this is not just that initial knee-jerk reaction, but, and this is, you know, getting maybe a little bit away from what Julie was writing about, but, you know, there is a culture and there is a community to skepticism. And absolutely, we do, are liable to the same kind of, social forces that all humans are. We're social creatures. You know, you can't help it. But honestly, in my opinion, I think that generally speaking, skeptics are less susceptible to groupthink than average because we basically are a group of people who are fiercely independent, at least like to think that they are. You know, we're essentially a group of people who don't like to belong to groups. So I think there is some part of the culture of skepticism is to push back against the culture of skepticism, which I think is a good thing. I think Michael Shermer first characterized that as, herding cats, you know, that sort of.
Yeah, was it him?
Uh-huh. Yeah, at least that's the first time I heard it.
You mean the phrase or?
No, just
the phrase applied to skeptics.
Applied to organized skepticism is like herding cats, you know.
Right.
You know, which is kind of a strength and a weakness of the movement, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't agree, but I don't disagree strongly enough because I have no evidence except for my own experience, which is seeing skeptics seem to fall for groupthink and other sort of things like that, just as often as non-skeptics.
Just as often?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there are many people out there who have very highly functioning bullshit detectors, but who don't, for one reason or another,
apply.
Maybe they don't know about skeptics as a community, or they just aren't interested in joining as a community. And so they're still out there being skeptical. It's just that they don't call themselves skeptics. And so I don't know. In my opinion, yeah, I just see a lot of same issues in the skeptic community that I see elsewhere. But, you know, I don't feel anything strong. Like, that's just my own observations. And I'd be interested in seeing actual, research done on it, whether people who think they're more, logical, more skeptical actually are so in their everyday lives. I'd be really interested in that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rebecca, and I was actually going to go there next as well. I think maybe the numbers will be different than the population at large. I do think there are, you know, self-identified skeptics who have the critical thinking to try to, like, not fall for groupthink. But just self-identifying as a skeptic isn't enough. You know, it's part of why, you know, I say just we're preaching to the choir is actually very useful in that we're trying to get people who self-identify ideologically as skeptics to be better at critical thinking and skepticism, because it's not easy. And the first thing that you do when you become like a critical thinker or endorse sort of the scientific outlook is you convince yourself that now you're immune to all of these biases, and, you know, you sort of fall for the ultimate self-deception of thinking that you don't fall for self-deception.
Yeah, it's the whole reason why Randy always talked about how important it was to have a magician in the laboratory, because, you know, scientists are very intelligent and are very good at what they do, which is a form of skepticism, but they're not necessarily looking out for types of fraud that
yes.
he would be looking out for.
Intentional,
and
yes.
Yeah, and their sort of confidence in that would blind them to those aspects.
And related to that is, you know, knowing a lot of people who are within the skeptical movement, you still see that people who are skeptics who are politically, say, libertarian, are much more likely to be global warming deniers, even though they're skeptics. And people who are skeptics who are ideologically liberal are much more likely to think that, you know, GM, you know, food is dangerous and evil. Just to give two examples. So yeah. those views hew very closely to political ideology, even within the skeptical community. But I do think, though, that somewhere in the middle are people that will take the view that goes along with the evidence, even if it goes against their political ideology, right? So you can get a libertarian skeptic to accept the reality of global warming, or a liberal skeptic to say, yeah, I guess GM foods actually are safe. One of my take homes for this, try to end it on a positive or constructive note, is that, you know, being a critical thinking skeptic is hard work. And just self-identifying as a skeptic isn't enough. It actually takes years. In my personal experience and my experience with other people, it takes years of introspection, of real intellectual work to get to the point where, you know, critical thinking and following a process of logic and evidence begins to seriously trump culture and ideology.
And even then, I think it's something you have to accept, that you are probably never going to overcome all of your sneaky internal biases and assumptions.
Yeah, never.
You
know, again,
you can only do the right. best you can.
Exactly. You minimize it. Can't exactly. eliminate it. You minimize it.
Yeah. But I think you can turn a corner where you're doing a pretty good job. But it's a journey. It's a never-ending journey. You're never going to arrive at perfect bias-free skepticism because we're flawed people. Never going to happen. All right. Thanks, Julie. Very intriguing question. Well, everyone, we're going to take another break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses. And this week we have a new course to offer you, Understanding the Science for Tomorrow, Myth and Reality, by MIT professor Jeffrey Grossman. Let me tell you guys, I'm about halfway through the course. I've listened to about half the lectures, and it's really, really a good course. I'm enjoying it. It's, first of all, it's, you know, it's wide ranging. It's a good primer on really all the basic technologies that make up our modern world. And then once he gets you up to speed on the basics of things like computing Nanotechnology, Bob, I know you're going to love that one. Brain science, energy, transportation, all sorts of things like that. Photography. Then he extrapolates a little bit, says, where is this going? Where's the next tech going to be? It's like a lot of the stuff we talk about on the show. Very good.
And what's cool is that even if that's not your bag, there are more than 500 subjects, science, math, history, art, music, you pick it. Anything that you are interested in, there will be a great courses for you.
And of course, you could watch it on any device that you want, which is awesome. You know, you're on your computer or you're in bed and you're on your iPad or your phone and you want to keep watching something that you started on the TV downstairs earlier. Very convenient.
So we obviously highly recommend the great courses and want you guys to give it a try. So the Great Courses has a special offer for our listeners. Order Understanding the Science of Tomorrow and get 80% off the original price. That is an amazing offer. Yeah, right? 80% savings, but it's only available for a limited time.
But what you'll need to do is go to thegreatcourses.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcourses.com/skeptics.
Do it now.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake-a-rooney. We have a theme this week and four items, because I'm just in that kind of mood. You know, we're recording a little early because we're gearing up to go to Dragon Con. We're going to be in Dragon Con next week after this show comes out, and we had to get a couple of shows ahead, so we're recording a little bit early. Always makes it challenging.
I'm so excited. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be fun. We haven't been in a couple of years, so it's very, very cool.
Yeah, that's true. We had to miss last year. And we're going to be doing a live performance Sunday night. It'll be the last event of the day in the Skeptic Track room.
Private
recording. We're going to sell 30 seats. It's always very popular. It always sells out very quickly. It's going to be $75 per ticket. We're setting up an online way to purchase tickets. Jay will give.
That's correct.
We'll have details. And, if there are any seats left, we'll be selling them at the event itself. But, you know, every one of these that we have done is sold out very quickly. That's my warning to you. Because they're a hell of fun. That's why. Mm. Well, let's move on to the science or fiction. You guys ready for the four items?
Yep.
Did I tell you the theme yet?
Yes.
No.
The theme is pterosaurs.
What?
Get the hell out. Come on.
What's a pterosaur?
It's a theme I know nothing about.
Good.
It's some type of crazy dinosaur.
Here we go. Pterosaurs.
They're awesome, by the way.
Item number one. The smallest pterosaur had a wingspan of 250 millimeters, or 10 inches. The species name there was Nemecolopterus. While the largest had a wingspan of 11 meters, or 36 feet, and weighed 550 pounds. And that was Quetzalcoatlus northropi.
Oh, I love that name. That's so cool.
Item number two. When first described, Pterodactylus was thought to be an aquatic creature that used its wings for flippers, a theory that remained popular for many decades. Item number three. Unlike birds, pterosaurs had solid bones, allowing them to run on all four limbs. And item number four. Pterosaurs were covered in hair, indicating that they were likely warm-blooded. Jay, go first.
All right, so after listening to all four of them, this is pretty much what I heard. Simma, sam, sam, simma, simma, sam, sim, simma, sam, sa, sam, sa, sam. Like, okay.
That's correct.
Let's see now. Random generator. I am going to roll. There's four of these, correct? Bob bought me for Christmas these awesome 3D printed D&D dice, and I am looking for the four-sider now. There it is. And here we go. I choose number two as the fake.
All right, so that's the pterodactylus is thought to be an aquatic creature. You think that one
Simma,
is the-
Simma, Sam, Simma, Simma, Sam. There you go. That's what I'm going with.
Okay. Let's see. Bob, you go next.
The pterosaur. 10 inches? Come on, really? 36 feet, I could see, 550. But 10 inches, I got some major tingling going on. Skeptical spider sense tingling, of course.
You've got 10 inches of tingling going on, Bob?
Let's
Good for
see,
you.
Uh, Pterodactylus. Cool name. Used its wings for flippers. Oh, none of these sound good to me. Let's see. Solid bones, allowing them to run on all four limbs. Yeah, four, though? Solid bones I could see, but all four? Let's see. Pterosaurs are covered in hair, indicating they were likely warm-blooded. Hair? What? Yeah, it could be a primitive type of feather. I mean, I should just roll some damn dice, too. This is
Yeah, but
pathetic.
You sent them all to Jay.
All right, I think I'm going to go with one. 10 inches seems too small. 36 feet wingspan, maybe, yeah, but 550 pounds? That looks, that seems like too high. All right, I'm going to go with that.
Okay, friction. Rebecca.
Damn.
Rebecca's predetermined number is number 3.
Oh, God, that's the only one that I, that's the only one that I thought was true. Not the idea of them having solid bones. I don't know anything about that, but I do, I'm pretty sure I remember seeing pictures of pterodactyls walking on all four limbs. But yeah, I don't know about the bone thing. I can picture them being covered in hair. You know what? I'm gonna GWB on this. I think I'll go with Bob. Although, see, that one, but that one seems true just because there's so much information there. Like,
Rebecca, you're making the mistake of thinking.
Oh, okay. GWB. Thank you.
Okay. Evan.
The name Quetzalcoatlus. Is it Quetzalcoatlus?
Quetzalcoatlus, yeah.
Quetzalcoatlus. That's such a great name.
Mayan? Is it Mayan?
No, it's a god in, which one?
The Aztec snake bird.
Aztecs. Thank you. Yes. It's so cool.
Mesoamerican, I think, technically.
Yeah, yeah. So that's very cool. It's for that reason alone, I think I'm going to go with the wingspan one. Although Bob, you said 10 inches too small. I don't know about that. I was thinking about the, pterosaurus covered in hair, and what you picked up on there, Bob, is that right? Is it really hair? Is it, you know, feathers? Is there some sort of point in which hair became feather to hair? Some, right? So that was a little tricky, but, since the die has spoken, I too will go with the wingspan 10 inches. That one's fiction.
Okay. Bob, Evan, and Rebecca think that the smallest to biggest pterosaur is the fiction. Jay thinks that the aquatic creature hypothesis is fiction. But you both agree in the last two, so I guess we'll go backwards. Number 4, pterosaurs were covered in hair, indicating that they were likely warm-blooded. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is.
Uh-oh.
So you remember how they were depicted on Jurassic Park, right? They were. And typically, I mean, the iconic, what people call a pterodactyl, which Bob is really just a common name. It doesn't exist. Pterodactyls are depicted as being leathery, because they're reptiles. But they, recent fossils, this one is true. This one is science because fossils have shown that they had some fuzz on them. They did have some hair. At least some of them did.
Cool.
And it also, because that would be used probably for temperature regulation, that implies that they may have been warm-blooded, which also makes sense because it would have been very hard to maintain the metabolism necessary for flight if they were cold-blooded. So that all seems to fit together. And Jay, while I'll mention at this point in time, as you mentioned early on, so pterosaurs, pterodactyloids, were not dinosaurs. They were in an extinct order of dinosaur of reptiles, but they were cousins to dinosaurs. They were closely related to dinosaurs, but they were not in the dinosaur clade.
Okay, then.
Got it?
That's probably one of the biggest misconceptions, I would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, about clade. Yeah, that they were a type of dinosaur. Yeah. Okay, number 3, unlike birds, pterosaurs had solid bones, allowing them to run on all four limbs. You guys also all think this one is science, and this one is. So, for a while,
is this a thing now?
Had no idea.
This is new thing.
This is my new thing.
New thing. It's 12 weeks now.
I'm going to keep doing it as long as Evan keeps laughing every time.
So forever. It's great.
No, only 12 more years. Come on.
I'll do it inconsistently, though. They didn't know how, if pterosaurs could, in fact, move along on the ground at all, then they thought that maybe they kind of shuffled or hopped on two legs. But, from fossil analysis, it seems pretty clear that they were able to walk on all four limbs,
cool.
folding their wings back, which looks really cool. However, this one
God
is
damn it.
the fiction.
What?
Ah, damn it. I should have gone with the
dice.
Because they had hollow bones like birds. They did not have solid bones. So don't know if they could, run. They could walk on their all four limbs. Probably couldn't run, but they had hollow, you know, almost identical to birds, hollow bones with, struts in the middle for support, but hollow to make them as light as possible for flight. So that one is the fiction. We'll keep working our way backward. When first described, Pterodactylus was thought to be an aquatic creature that used its wings for flippers, a theory that remained popular for many decades. That one, of course, is science. I thought that was very interesting. So the first scientist that described, Italian naturalist Cosimo Alessandro, and Alessandro thought that the wings were flippers and that these were like aquatic amphibious type creatures. This was in the 1700s. But in the early 1800s, George Cuvier correctly surmised that these were flying creatures. And he was very persuasive, and the scientific community fairly quickly came around to his way of thinking. Later specimens confirmed that these were, yes, indeed, flying and not aquatic creatures. Guys are really excited about this one. All right, let's go to number one. The smallest pterosaur had a wingspan of 250 millimeters or 10 inches, while the largest had a wingspan of 11 meters or 36 feet and weighed 550 pounds. That one, of course, is science. So, yeah, there were over 120 known species. There probably were many more. That's
120? Whoa.
Yeah, that we've identified so far.
Thought there were
They reigned as long as the dinosaurs.
Good for
them. They ruled the skies of the Earth for 150 million years. They were wiped out in 66 million years ago at the same time the dinosaurs did. Very successful, very widespread group, you know, and they, you know, once you get to the point where you can fly, you know, that's a huge advantage. The smallest ones were no bigger than sparrows. I mean, 10 inch wingspan, that's like a sparrow.
Oh,
tiny.
Wow.
And the biggest ones were the biggest flying creatures to have ever lived. In addition to Quetzalcoatlus, there was also another one that was just about the same size.
Man, I want to see one of these in action. Why couldn't at least the little ones have survived?
I know. Wouldn't that be cool? That stinks. Little sparrow-sized pterosaurs.
I want a pet pterosaur.
Yeah,
but then you'd feed them, they'd grow up, and you'd have three of them, and it'd be a black one and a green one.
Ah, nice, Jay.
Start putting an army together.
So Hatzigopteryx thambina was also about the same size, 36 feet. So these things, that's a bigger wingspan than an F-16. Think about it. These things were bigger than fighter jets at the big end. And yeah, Bob, 550 pounds. That really surprised me. That's freaking heavy.
That's heavy as hell.
Or 250 kilograms. That means the load on their wings were greater than any living bird.
Wasn't the atmosphere different though in some way that made flight easier for heavier creatures, or
was higher oxygen?
There was more oxygen, you know, which could definitely, because they would have needed the oxygen in order to produce the amount of, you know, power that they needed, the amount of energy. Yeah, it could have been thicker as well. I don't quite remember that. If it was, it was definitely the higher levels of atmospheric oxygen,
which allowed for the really big insects, right?
Yeah, also the big insects, right? So really amazing creatures. I love the depictions of them walking, you know, with their wings folded back up.
Yeah, kind of awkward though, but cool.
Yeah, and that's kind of the trend now in depicting dragons is sort of the same way.
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
I have a really nice quote.
Do you, Jay?
I do.
I can't wait. Let me hear it.
Quote it.
So sent in by a listener named D. Raithniak. Wow.
Wow.
D, I'm sorry. And D's from Australia. And the quote is, this might be a good quote if it hasn't already been used. That's not the quote. That's what D wrote to me.
I was going to say, it's a little meta.
Yeah.
The eye sees only what the mind is prepared to comprehend.
Yeah.
And that is from a French philosopher who won a Nobel Prize in Literature, Henri Louis Bergson.
Nice.
Thank you, Jay. Yeah, definitely an iconic quote.
Yeah, that's so, so true.
Hey, guys, a quick reminder. The lawsuit is continuing, and costs are mounting.
Ouch.
I think things are starting to ramp up a little bit. I mean, the quickie update is that the other guy's attorney is doing a lot of paperwork, literally, we think, just to make the cost go up to try to scare us.
Well, this is the phase of this kind of lawsuit where it's kind of a game of chicken. You know, it's like who's going to,
you know, everything increased the costs. Yeah, every time there's a motion and a counter motion and a counter motion, and there's a lot of legal maneuvering. A lot of it is strategic, but certainly trying to make it as painful as possible for the defendant is one of the strategies. So we do greatly appreciate the ongoing support that we're getting from our listeners, and it is making this possible. You know, we're staying in the game because we have support from you guys. So we appreciate it. All right. Well, thank you for joining me again this week, everyone.
Sure, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.